We're going to continue in our study of Revelation chapter 18. It's going to be part 2 of 3 that we're going to be looking at, the fall of Babylon. And let's see, we want to just give a brief review here. So this whole judgment against Babylon began in chapter 17, where John was told he was going to be shown this judgment against Babylon. Babylon is a metaphor for Rome of John's time. And her problem was sexual immorality and the wine of her sexual immorality. And we've mentioned this repeatedly, that sexual immorality is not to be understood to be pressed literally, but it is a metaphor for combining or trying to combine God's principles with the world's principles. God's way of doing things with the world's way of doing things. We've seen that the nations, the kings of the earth, and the merchants have now participated in the sexual immorality and have drunk of the wine of sexual immorality. So sexual immorality is, more specifically, is taking part in the false premise of worldly power, prestige, influence, and respectability. The wine of sexual immorality would be the intoxicating temptations of the false premise. Babylon lives in the power of luxury and sensuality. She claims to be above the natural consequences of actions, and she even claims to be able to alter the consequences. She claims to have the power to offer easy living to all who accept and participate in her ways. Her sin is self-reliance. She believes she can control what goes on. And therefore, judgment is handed down on Babylon. We saw that evil turns on itself. The great prostitute sitting on the beast with the 10 horns, the 10 horns representing kings, turn on the prostitute and cause her to be tormented and burned up. We've interpreted that to say that it's essentially God's removal of the hand of his mercy, which allows the full consequences to come down and to take effect. It's said that it will take place surprisingly quickly. The exact language used was in a single day, in chapter 18, verse 8. And the result of this judgment is that sin, which is faithlessness and self-reliance, is shown for what it is, and God's ways are shown to be the only path that leads to actual life. The saints have been calling for vindication, for judgment all along, and so this is the judgment that the saints want to see. Now, the saints are not calling for vengeance upon their oppressors, but rather a vindication of God and of their trust in him. And so we mentioned two different views of justice, punitive versus restorative. Punitive simply means you must impose some kind of punishment in order to fulfill the demands of justice. Restorative justice is essentially, God does what is necessary in order to show that the way to life, and to provide a way to life, to show that the way of life can only be found by following his ways, and he provides the power and the means to follow that path to life. And with that, the actual judgment on Babylon is concluded in verse 8 of chapter 18. So what is the next section? It contains three funeral verses. This is from the ESV Study Bible Notes. As the ancient Greek chorus interpreted actions in a drama, so a succession of speakers explains the significance of the prostitute's desolation as she is deserted by the beast that once supported her and the kings who once adored her.
So are those in this section? Are we going to read it?
We are going to read it.
Okay.
So what this is saying is, essentially, it gives further evidence to the premise that Revelation is written as a kind of a drama, using Greek dramatic forms. This next section is essentially a commentary on what has come. So this is another reason to not read Revelation as describing events that must literally take place. It's dramatic form, it's using metaphors. And John borrows heavily from Ezekiel chapters 26 through 28, which is an oracle against the ancient city of Tyre. Let's see. Some historical background on Tyre. It was a Phoenician port and kingdom located on an island originally situated some 700 miles, or 700 meters, which is 1,300 feet. 1,300 feet offshore and about 35 kilometers or 22 miles south of Sidon.
Offshore.
It was a rock. It was on a rock.
Got it. Okay. So basically a little island.
Tyre, if I recall correctly, it was in two parts. There was a part on the mainland, and then the greater part of it was on this offshore piece of land. The ancient city had two havens, the northern harbor and the southern Egyptian harbor. Unlike other Phoenician kingdoms, Tyre seems not to have capitulated to the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser I. This is the Assyrian king that basically conquered the entire region and brought it under his control, but Tyre appears to have kept its independence. During his siege of Tyre in 332, however, Alexander the Great was able to capture the city by constructing a mole to connect the island to the mainland. The primary pursuit of the Tyrian-Israelite pact was to secure large quantities of luxury goods by means of joint maritime ventures on both the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. One such allied fleet sailed to Tarshish, which is believed to have been south Spain, to secure precious metals, ivory, and exotic animals, while the Red Sea fleet journeyed to Ophir to acquire gold, timber, and precious stone. Now I just now want to read some bits from Ezekiel. Ezekiel 26, verse 4. They shall destroy the walls of Tyre and break down her towers, and I will scrape her soil from her and make her a bare rock. Down to verse 8. He will kill with the sword your daughters on the mainland. He will set up a siege wall against you and throw up a mound against you and raise a roof of shields against you. He will direct the shock of his battering rams against your walls, and with his axes he will break down your towers. His horses will be so many that their dust will cover you. Your walls will shake at the noise of the horsemen and wagons and chariots when he enters your gates as men enter a city that has been breached. With the hoofs of his horses he will trample all your streets. He will kill your people with the sword, and your mighty pillars will fall to the ground. They will plunder your riches and loot your merchandise. They will break down your walls and destroy your pleasant houses. Your stones and timber and soil they will cast into the midst of the waters. Verse 16. Then all the princes of the sea will step down from their thrones and remove their robes and strip off their embroidered garments. They will clothe themselves with trembling. They will sit on the ground and tremble every moment and be appalled at you. And they will raise a lamentation over you and say to you, how you have perished, you who were inhabited from the seas, O city renowned, who was mighty on the sea. She and her inhabitants impose their terror on all her inhabitants. Now the coastlands tremble on the day of your fall, and the coastlands that are on the sea are dismayed at your passing. Jumping down to chapter 27, verse 3, and say to Tyre, who dwells at the entrances to the sea, merchant of the peoples to many coastlands, thus says the Lord God, O Tyre, you have said, I am perfect in beauty. Jumping down to, and then there's this next section, this chapter 27, the first part of it is basically a catalog of all the types of trade, all the goods, the merchandise that Tyre trades in, and how it uses the nations around and the peoples around it in order to maintain its trade and its luxury. Verse 9 of chapter 27. The elders of Gebal and her skilled men were in you, caulking your seams. All the ships of the sea with their mariners were in you to barter for your wares. Persia and Lud and Put were in your army as your men of war. They hung the shield and helmet in you. They gave you splendor. Men of Arvad and Helek were on your walls around. And men of Gamad were in your towers. They hung their shields on your walls all around. They made perfect your beauty. Tarshish did business with you because of your great wealth of every kind. Silver, iron, tin, and lead they exchanged for your wares. Javan, Tubal, and Mesek traded with you. They exchanged human beings and vessels of bronze for your merchandise. Skipping down to 18, verse 18, Damascus did business with you for your abundant goods, because of your great wealth of every kind, wine of Helbon and wool of Sahar. Jumping down to verse 25, the ships of Tarshish traveled for you with your merchandise, so you were filled and heavily laden in the heart of the seas. Your rowers have brought you out into the high seas. The east wind has wrecked you in the heart of the seas. Your riches, your wares, your merchandise, your mariners and your pilots, your caulkers, your dealers in merchandise, and all your men of war who are in you, with all your crew that is in your midst, sink into the heart of the seas on the day of your fall. At the sound of the cry of your pilots, the countryside shakes, and down from their ships come all who handle the oar. The mariners and all the pilots of the sea stand on the land and shout aloud over you and cry out bitterly. They cast dust on their heads and wallow in ashes, and they make themselves bald for you and put sackcloth on their waist, and they weep over you in bitterness of soul with bitter mourning. In their wailing they raise a lamentation for you and lament over you. Who is like Tyre, like one destroyed in the midst of the sea? When your wares came from the seas, you satisfied many peoples with your abundant wealth and merchandise. You enriched the kings of the earth. Now you are wrecked by the seas and the depths of the waters. Your merchandise and all your crew in your midst has sunk with you. All the inhabitants of the coastlands are appalled at you, and the hair of their kings bristles with horror. Their faces are convulsed. The merchants among the peoples hiss at you. You have come to a dreadful end and shall be no more forever. Chapter 28, verse 2. Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, thus says the Lord God, because your heart is proud, and you have said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of gods, in the heart of the seas. Yet you are but a man, and no god, though you make your heart like the heart of a god. By your wisdom and your understanding, you have made wealth for yourself and have gathered gold and silver into your treasuries. By your great wisdom in your trade, you have increased your wealth, and your heart has become proud in your wealth. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, because you make your heart like the heart of a god, therefore, behold, I will bring foreigners upon you, the most ruthless of the nations, etc., etc., etc. And skipping to verse 12. Son of man, raise a lamentation of the king of Tyre, and say to him, thus says the Lord God, you were the signet of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Skipping down to 15. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till unrighteousness was found in you. In the abundance of your trade, you were filled with violence in your midst, and you sinned. So I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O guardian cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was proud because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I exposed you before kings to feast their eyes on you. By the multitude of your iniquities and the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuary. So I brought fire out from your midst. It consumed you. And I turned you to ashes on the earth in the sight of all who saw you. Finally, skipping to verse 25, chapter 28. Thus says the Lord God, when I gather the house of Israel from the peoples among whom they are scattered, and manifest my holiness in them in the sight of the nations, then they shall dwell in their own land that I gave to my servant Jacob. And they shall dwell securely in it, and they shall build houses and plant vineyards. They shall dwell securely when I execute judgments upon all their neighbors who have treated them with contempt. And then they will know that I am the Lord their God. That is the oracle, the prophecy against Tyre.
Would Tyre have known that? I mean, that's old written, right? And they could have read that?
Probably.
Alexander knew it.
So what can we infer from Ezekiel about Tyre? It apparently had extensive fortification. It has walls, towers, pillars. It had a powerful navy. It was able to impose its will on the seas. And so consequently, she probably believed herself invulnerable to outside attack. But as it turns out, she falls to a more powerful military force, a more cunning military force.
And a mole is just they put rock in and put...
They filled.
I thought a mole was like a hole. How would they do that?
Yeah, I was wondering.
From Ezekiel, we can see that it was a central hub for trade. She was able to purchase mercenaries from nations about. So her reliance was on her ability to generate wealth and to pay for whatever she wanted. So consequently, she probably believed herself indispensable to the surrounding nations' economies. Well, she was the center of economy.
They bought from her.
Yeah. But, as it turns out, the ambitions of other nations turned them against her. She discovers that her trade is not enough to keep enemies away. She trusts in her power over the sea. That is metaphorically, that is a powerful thing because the sea represents chaos. Mm-hmm. For the ancients. The ancients feared to travel far from coast. But there are some signs, there's some indications, at least in this passage in Ezekiel, that the mariners of Tyre did not fear the high seas. She believed she had the power, the capability, the skills to control what happened on the seas. But in the oracle, it is the sea, not just the military, the nations around, the armies of nations around that cause her demise, but it is the sea itself that turns against her.
A tsunami.
In the oracle against the Prince of Tyre, he sees himself as powerful as the gods. He believes he has the power to control events, nations, commerce, and peoples. His security and his faith is on his ability to generate wealth. And then that's followed by a lament over the king of Tyre. It appears that it is his preoccupation with wealth that leads to reliance on violence or force to accomplish what he wants. And that is specifically pointed out as the sin that causes God to act. Wisdom was given to him, and it was misused for personal gain, through the abuse of others. And this oracle concludes with a note stating that lasting security can only be found in the Lord God. And so with that, we can now come back to Revelation 18, verses 9 through 19. There's a pattern in each of these dirges. The subject is given, and then there is the reason for the subject's mourning over Babylon's fall is given. The subjects stand far off in fear of torment. Essentially, they are afraid that they will be a part of this destruction and fall. That's followed by, alas, alas. And then the regret about what Babylon offered to the subject. And then it ends with a phrase, for in a single hour. And we noted in verse 8 that this single day and this single hour that appears in each of the dirges is essentially the same thing, meaning a very short, almost instantaneous period of time. So let's read these verses, 9 to 19. And the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, alas, alas, you great city, you mighty city, Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, and sheep, horses, and chariots, and slaves, that is, human souls. The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your delicacies and your splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels, and with pearls, for in a single hour all this wealth has been laid waste. And all shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors, and all whose trade is on the sea stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, alas, alas, for the great city where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth, for in a single hour she has been laid waste.
So I always think of, when I say Tyre, I also think of Sidon. What happened to Sidon? Where is Sidon?
Sidon was 35 kilometers
north,
south of Sidon. Sidon used to be the major city of the coastal peoples in that area, but that was taken over by Tyre.
Okay.
They're both
fancy cities.
Phoenician peoples. First dirge, the subject is the kings of the earth. Their reason for mourning, they were partners with Babylon in promoting her as source of security and wealth. Even though they turned against Babylon, and this was described in chapter 17, verse 16, they mourn because not only Babylon, but the principles she promoted are also shown to be false. Well, they didn't like that Babylon was outshining them. Part of the problem of promoting self is that, you know, when someone else becomes more prominent, you don't like that. You try to take them down. In the process of taking down Babylon, the kings of the earth discovered that the entire principle, the foundations upon which they based their power, crumbled.
I think the fear that luxury is slipping away from them permanently is devastating. You know, because they're used to luxury.
Yeah. So, for the kings of the earth, Babylon offered might and power.
Okay, back to history. Tyre was taken out by Alexander the Great.
I believe it was finally taken out by Alexander the Great. Babylon tried, and they succeeded partway. But they never got to the rock.
This was far in the future for Ezekiel.
Yes.
This was in the past for John.
Okay.
Is it possible that rather than writing prophetic, you know, this isn't prophecy is what will happen to some country. This is prophecy to say this will what will happen with this form of government. So if your form of government, no matter if it's United States or if it's Rome or if it's whoever, if you put your trust in self and security and wealth, what happened to Tyre is going to happen to you. So it's prophecy of consequences rather than prophecy of actions.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm hearing. Because it kind of feeds on the United States right now because we are wealthy and we're the envy of the world. But if the world takes our wealth away, the whole world's going to collapse. And that's kind of what this is saying, is when you build...
Makes sense.
Second dirge. The subject is merchants of the earth. Their reason for mourning, commerce has died. You take out this, when the center of trade goes down, well, what happens?
It's going to collapse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What Babylon offered to them, it was wealth and luxury. Essentially, the entire economic system that these merchants relied on is gone.
On both sides. It hurts both.
Yeah. This is the longest of the three dirges, with a center section that's not present in the other two. Part of that long center section is a long catalog of the merchants' wares. It echoes the catalog that's found in Ezekiel 27 of the different types of trade and things that were going on. The catalog ends with slaves. This phrase, slaves, that is human souls. Slaves, the Greek is soma, meaning physical body. Souls is psyche, meaning can be interpreted as a person. So the interpretation of this particular phrase, now there's many different interpretations, but what I think is the best one is that what the merchants were doing is they were abusing people, reducing them to mere human resources. You know, they were treating them as numbers, as bodies, as resources rather than as people. Now we today do not in our lives have slaves, literal slaves. But
depends on your perspective.
But do we treat people as mere resources?
If you've ever built a subdivision, you know exactly what is going on. This is no different. I don't believe they're saying an actual slave in here, because all the people that were living off of the service economy that was being developed were all slaves to that economy, and the people that were servicing them with those goods and continuing that life of quote-unquote luxury that they wanted them to believe in were using those consumers as the people to generate their wealth, and the more that they had of them, the better off they were. So it's no different in our ideology today, where because the work that I did was we built a school when the developers had built enough homes to constitute having the school in that area. And as you're driving through the unfinished subdivisions that are slowly becoming populated, on these areas, you're looking around to wonder what is the resource that's developing this area, and it started to turn out more and more that there was no actual resource that was developing the area. It was the commerce of the service industry that was bringing those people to that area. So they were.
It was the act of building that was bringing people in.
More was the act of buying. So the people that were, they were all working in the service industry, period. Like, there was no longer were there people going down and taking a resource to boil it down into a service job. It was just, these people went to an accountant for a job. They accounted somebody else's money, that went to going to a restaurant for a job, that went to owning a garden supply store, that people went to buy garden supplies for their house for. And no longer was there an actual resource developed around it, but it was just people servicing people's interests more than anything else around. And it got to a point where finally that it was all about the goods that were being brought into the area to generate the economy that made that.
Well, anytime there's luxury and ease, that means they aren't physically doing the things that on a daily activities needs doing. And so somebody else is doing the food cooking, the lawn mowing, the mm-hmm. you know, all these things. So luxury always yeah. has its slaves in the fact that they may be paid, but they're paid less,
mm-hmm.
you know, because somebody has more to pay them, you know.
Yeah.
But it does provide jobs, you know. I don't know.
I think what this is getting at, though, is not merely that, you know, someone is... It's more of the abuse
mm-hmm.
of seeing a person not as a person anymore, but simply as a means.
A statistic, a number.
A wealthy person can hire many other people, and it can still see each person as a person and treat them respectfully.
Mm-hmm.
But say a Walmart is there to generate money, and they've got to get people into the store to shop and spend money, and each person isn't seen as a person necessarily. The amount of money that they can bring into the company.
The problem that we have with this is we kind of understand the world's systems of wealth and security. The other side, we kind of know about, but we really don't understand it, and that's the problem, we still don't.
No.
There is an economy that works, that isn't abusive, that does bring happiness. And we honestly do, as humans, we don't understand that.
But that's kind of what we were going through last week, was that everybody in a faithful environment that gets to this point starts to think that they have to revert to caveman mentality in order to no longer be a part of the world's working. Which is not true, because what's happening in a service industry environment is that everybody is putting all of their faith to the ideology that this is what's going to take care of them. This is what makes the world safe and whole. Whereas if we just built that same economy on the ideology that if it was all wiped clean instantly, we would all try to take care of a human being as a human being, not, oh my gosh, I just lost all of my ants in my ant farm and I need to regrow them. Not, you know, and so that's what the particular difference is that you're not, you know, it's not that your luxury items or that the items of the world mean that much to the person that they can't live without them or that they couldn't do it themselves. And that's the lamenting of the people standing on the shore going, what do we do now?
I don't know the answer.
So verse 14 is kind of a parenthetical comment regarding this whole thing. So it's just saying that all this that you worked for is gone. Third dirge. The subject. All who work in the sea trade. Their reason for mourning? Their means of living is gone. What Babylon offered was wealth and security. And they ask, what city was like the great city? In Ezekiel, there was a question. Who is like Tyre? In Revelation 13:4, there was a question. Who is like the beast? If the great city Babylon can be defeated and destroyed, well, what about the beast? Maybe it can be destroyed too.
What was the beast? What could be strong?
The beast was the security of your own self-interest, being that you can take care of everything yourself without needing God.
It's the opposite of lasting security is only found
right.
in the Lord.
But in their, in His time,
the beast would be Rome.
What they were riding around in their present imminent time was.
Well, Rome was the oppressor.
Babylon, the great prostitute, beast, they all represent aspects of Rome.
And so.
They had soldiers everywhere ready to keep oppressed.
But you were saying that this was Rome still in the development stage. It hadn't started to collapse.
It hadn't started collapsing.
So this was not really very nicely received by the Roman Empire, because they says, what do you mean? This is what we're supposed to be doing.
We're supposed to give them security. Keep things status quo.
So that those are the three dirges, funeral dirges for Babylon. So they are commentaries, they are explanation, they describe through a voice of a chorus, three different choruses, what the judgment on Babylon means. So for us, what is maybe the interpretation? This next long paragraph comes from reading Revelation. The dominant, though by no means only, element in the description of Babylon in this section has been the economic element. Once again, one should not press the details literally here, but at the same time, one cannot help but notice the parallels between the arrogance of Babylon and that of the church at Laodicea, which prided itself on its prosperity. There are also strong parallels to the situation in the church at Thyatira, where Jezebel's false teaching might be connected with participation in trade guilds. The reader also remembers the mark of the beast, without which one cannot buy or sell. Add to these virtually no interest in this section on military prowess or idolatry, and the reader can infer only that the economic emphasis must be more than simply traditional. John's readers are, at least in part, being enticed by the socio-economic system of Rome. Hence, they need to come out of her. Perhaps this is why the judgment of the great harlot takes precedence even over the judgment of the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon in this section, both in terms of space allotted and in terms of John's initial orientation to his third in the spirit experience in 17 verse 1. It is the temptation to accommodate to the surrounding culture as much as, or perhaps more than, the threat of outright persecution that is the most serious problem faced by the seven churches of Asia. The book of Revelation reveals the answer to the question asked by every generation, where can lasting security be found? Revelation reveals false sources of security and their ultimate end. Wealth and luxury, they are temporal, they can be destroyed. Power, prestige, and influence is great until someone stronger or more charismatic comes along. Human wisdom and reasoning, they can fail. Force and violence, used to both promote and to protect one's interests, they will be turned and used against the one using them. Self-gratification and self-aggrandizement are essentially deceptions to mask reality. So the message of the book of Revelation is to choose rightly who and what to worship. And this message is applicable throughout church history, not just to the end time. what's being described in Revelation is firstly about Rome, about the immediate circumstances and situation being faced by the church at that time. But it is applicable beyond her. It's not about Rome when it comes down to it. It's about the foundation, the systems, the principles that Rome is promoting, and that the church is being tempted to accept, to accommodate. So each generation of the church faces these same temptations and these same choices.
Is that why he's writing to the church? Because more often than not, the church seeks those securities for their people before even the outside world starts to. I mean, when you go to a church, there's doctrines, their ideologies, their security with each other and stuff like that tends to pull them closer into that ideology faster than even when you're living outside in it can tend to do.
We discussed last week that fear is the primary motivator for human beings. We seek to eliminate fear. And therefore, security is the greatest temptation.
We seek to eliminate the thing we're afraid of.
Yeah.
There is no biblical or Christian economic system or political system or social system or any system. So, neither capitalism or communism or socialism
are inherently right or wrong.
Democracy versus monarchy versus dictatorship, inherently there's no right or wrong in any of those.
Christianity
must
be appropriate.
Remain separate from those things of the world.
You know, what you've been saying, you need to say about 4 or 5 times, but people aren't going to see it. Because this thing about fear is so true. We just need to have it beat in our head.
So why is it so important in our church society as Christians that they structure it so diligently to mirror those aspects of those other systems that we're not supposed to be involved?
Because control offers stability.
Security.
Right. So almost every faith-based religion in the entirety of our world resides around some sort of structured form of worship that makes sure that each and every person is at a level that they can be judged at.
In our society, which I thought was stupid, but in more recent years I start seeing what they're doing is, we have really focused on mission statements. So companies or organizations or groups are encouraged to draw up their mission statement. And, you know, if we could draw up our mission statement, and I've done this with SolarWind, every time I make a decision or something, if I could go through these 5 elements and say, is this decision based upon wealth, luxury, power, prestige, etc.? That's what it's about. Why am I doing what I'm doing?
Yeah, part of what's behind all this is Jesus gave up all those things. Those were not motivators for Jesus.
But as soon as a church becomes organized, it tends to work toward its own self-preservation. And in order to do that, it has to organize with...
It has to use the
organizational systems in order to provide security for its people, and in order to keep itself going and promote itself.
But it is only you, and it's me that's doing that. I'm on the board of the church. And so I am making those decisions, and the church is only a reflection of the individuals who are working on that premise. It is so common that when people get wealthy, I'm going to hire someone to clean my house. I'm going to hire someone to do my gardening. I'm going to hire someone to clean my car. Well, in actuality, some of those activities are what you enjoy doing the most.
Oh, yeah. You like doing
both. Some.
Which, in other words, instead of living, you're paying someone to live for you.
Exactly. And it's the individual.
Wow.
And it is, honey, I am correct in saying that most of the ritualistic chores that we do away with is what people enjoy. A dairy farmer can't retire because they really enjoy the farming. Pastors never retire because they really are a pastor. You can't retire from who you are.
When you realize that the work you do is what life is, rather
than
being
an engineer, so you keep
rather than the things that you have to get through in order to go do life.
Exactly. So when you're living your whole life to be top man on the totem pole, you're actually destroying what you're trying to who you are. Because you're competing with someone else who they are. Well, let them be who they are, and you can be who you are. And you...
Well, I think, according to, if you have a kind dictator, kind people under them, then you're operating in the laws of God, and things can be wonderful. But if you have somebody who is self-caught up about themselves, mm-hmm. or something,
and
then
the
it can be selfish,
sure
selfish, them. Selfish, you know, we want to be the best, the greatest, and we'll keep all these little numbers working for us.
A dictatorship, or a benevolent dictatorship.
Yeah, so, like, you're saying any kind of government is just what it is.
It's the people.
Any type of system can work, because it's not about the system. It's about the motivations of that are underlying.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
on
system.
An individual basis.
There are reasons for all the different systems, and they were all created because they have good in them, and they can all work.
Different peoples,
but they all get corrupted. They all get corrupted and work to serve themselves, and they all become corrupt, inappropriate.
So it comes back to, are these the mission statement for myself? And that's all the farther I should take it. I can take it.
You can only control your decision. But at the same time, what John is doing is he's pointing out the dangers. That a collective, because he is writing to a collective church.
Mm-hmm.
And as a collective church, it has far more ability to influence.
To focus on power. To get the power.
I think, for me, I've always used a captain and ship scenario to form my utopic situation. Because in my mind, I don't believe that that like a capitalistic or a monarch situation works, because generally it's about what one individual can create for itself in a stable environment that it tailors.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you're a captain in an environment that you cannot control at all, you can only control the decisions that you make to get the best outcome that you can have.
Mm-hmm.
And what that involves is a complete cohesive effort between the officers, the crew, and every person that's down to the boiling point of getting the water out of the bilge. And they have to collectively agree that the captain's ability is what will get them where they need to be. And it's not that that person is not doing it for the preservation of his place as far as what he's created, but it's more for the preservation of the cargo and the people that are on the vessel to get to the place of safety that they need to get to.
When the leaders are truly servants of the people,
right,
then all the systems of government actually can work.
Because on a boat with a good captain, and I learned this a long time ago as a young captain, blaming things on people on my boat that were responsible for something of a decision that I made, becoming upset with their life and their situation because I thought that they persuaded my decision. Mm-hmm. So as I started to realize that the perfect understanding of the safety, the security, and the understanding that we all come through this as alive as we can be is the best prospect for control, I guess you could say. And that has to start with the person that's leading the group, as far as we need to know that we're all doing this together to be as safe as we can be, to work as hard as we can together. And I just think that, to me, that's been my best analogy for what works the most.
That makes sense, yeah.
Because I've never seen it work in a more solidified environment.
Well, when it gets bigger, it becomes corrupt.
Well, no, because you can go out on a big boat.
Yeah.
But the problem is that your situation is never solidified.
I see.
You're never creating every aspect of what you're doing yourself. You are always subject to a variable.
In other words, the person at the top is always at the mercy of something above them, which is the weather, the...
Everything.
Mm-hmm.
The entire collective effort is greater than they can ever be, period. Your hull could breach, your machinery can break down, people can get sick and die. There's more variable, and you can never collect it all and maintain it all in one spot if you're in that situation, and I think people tend to forget that.
Interesting.
So one thing that
in a government, you forget.
Yes. Because you've solidified your defenses, you've solidified your economy, you've solidified, and you're on a
you
solid base. You
forget the people at the top are below something, that there's something above everything.
Right, there is an imminent danger that could come to them at any time.
Huh. We do it within our language. What's the top? Who's above whom? Mm-hmm. Who's paid more than someone else? Mm-hmm. Is going up good or is going down good? In our language, we create those preconceived ideas that the top is the best. Sometimes the top, for some personalities, would be the worst place to be. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be lower down and mm-hmm. less stress.
There is a kind of dualism where, as individual Christians, we are subject to the governments of the world, mm-hmm. the governing forces of the world. But at the same time, Christians form a different community called the church, mm-hmm. which must not conform. That's Revelation. Must not conform, must not accommodate, must not employ those forms of government that work mm-hmm. in the world. Mm-hmm. And as a church, then, part of its job is to stand there and critique the world. That's what John is doing through Revelation. He's critiquing the world. He's saying, come out, because those things don't work. In the long run, the more you are involved in that, those sorts of things, the more you absorb those things, the more you are influenced by them, the more likely you will end up being destroyed by them.
Yeah. We say those things don't work, but we really, really don't believe it. Because we see it working every day of our lives. Wealth, security, honor,
mm-hmm. prestige. You think we're
so it's so easy to begin organizing your spiritual life, your church family, based on those same principles.
It's just, oh, you want a building committee? Go for it.
How do you collectively
resist that?
Well, how do you organize collectively without that?
We don't
have a systematic. We want a systematic form. We don't have an understanding of a man's mind and letting people do things that should be done. And are they going to do them the way that we want them done? We don't have that.
I think that if you have, say, a mega church with 3,000 people all together, you have to have that organization. And if you don't organize it based on those principles, you will cease to have a mega church.
What she just said, have to, is the whole crux of it. If we really think we have to, there is another way. We just don't know where it is. There is.
Yeah. Well, and there you can get together 3,000 Christians and worship together, but in order to have the organization that is the megachurch, you have to organize. And if you don't organize, you will cease to have the organization of 3,000 people all as a unified church.
And nobody's fixing the plumbing when the toilet goes out.
Well, as a unified church. And if the goal is to have 3,000 people as a unified organization church.
Well, what's the motivation behind it?
Is it power? Is it?
Well, there's a belief that the belief is, yeah, you have more influence.
Must be right.
Influence.
With a large church, a large, powerful, active church can have more influence in the world. Is that true?
Is influence good?
Yeah.
Influence is neutral, but
yeah,
in itself
but
is neutral.
They can have.
It's real close to
five.
It is.
Doesn't have a great deal of influence in the organizations of the world.
But it's okay to have a desire to have influence.
I'll tell you what, you have a lot of influence. Because
individuals can have influence.
A lot of people.
Individuals can have influence. But organizations, if the organization wants to have influence, you need to be bigger. And 3,000 people can keep together and choose to worship together, but they won't have organizational influence unless they organize. And if they don't organize, they'll evolve and they will change. And we
but
are
only influencing.
Change. We can't have change. So we have
to
organize to keep everybody together and keep everybody from changing.
Well, that's why I think that pertaining everything to what goes on in the nautical form is that everything that's really big is always really susceptible to danger because its inability to maneuver. Its mass is its only form of
diversity.
And then they are always in a bigger target.
Well, in the first part of Acts, Jerusalem is the center of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Very first part. You have thousands.
Whew.
And then
it evolves.
Yeah, and then what God allows persecution
to
disperse them.
What if may good come of it?
And that's why I think the ocean thing is the
if
way
God,
to go. Because
if God say, you're going to get persecuted
it.
Now.
I'm not just saying it because it's the only thing I know. I'm saying that, the reason why I say that is because there's always something that you have to get away from or to work against or to work with or to be fluid.
It's constantly evolving.
You can never sustain on the same exact thing twice. You always have to think differently every time. The wind does not blow the same every day. It just does not.
Heaven does it?
I don't think so.
Is there diversity in heaven?
There has to be. If you look at life itself, it cannot live. Life itself, if you break it down to, if you do the wrong thing and you worship just the creation, if you look right at the creation itself, it can't even do the same thing.
Is there unity in heaven?
Yes.
There's a certain kind of unity.
See, that's
because unity of worship?
Because
unity
we,
of worship?
You know, our motivations, each of our motivations is corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
It's, at least in this life, it's probably not possible to experience and to have that kind of voluntary unity that happens in under perfect motivations.
You'll see it on a ship. You will see it on a ship. I guarantee you will. I guarantee it. You will see the most collected people in the world when the world starts to fall apart on that boat. You will always see the majority of the population on that vessel will become the most unified people. And
because they're all interested in staying afloat.
They are all interested in staying alive.
As soon as they hit port, what happens?
Sometimes. But I'm only saying that because it is one of the most purest places to always see what is available, what man can do. No, I don't know. It's different.
See, even there though,
kind
of what I hear though is there's some kind of a fear. And
there isn't always a fear.
But that's the potential for chaos at any moment.
We, as human beings, with our faulty perspectives, it's nearly impossible to understand how someone can be motivated without fear. Whether it's the fear—it's fear of losing something, fear of something.
We're on a big cliff, and that's a big fear.
No, I understand. There is that the fear, but I have seen I've seen the situation more often than I can explain it eloquently. But there isn't always a fear. There's also an understanding that you know you're capable of. I mean, this is not a fearful situation. This is a quiet calm where everybody is completely capable of what they're doing, and they know that this situation is out of their hands, but they know that their quiet ability to let other people do the job that they have to, because as a captain, you can't always run down the deck and make sure that guy does his job. You have to quietly observe and hope that they will do what they're doing. Not hope, but just know. You have to know that everybody's going to do it.
Does the constant potential for chaos play a role, though, in that calm and the trust?
Some of them love the chaos, though. Some of them are bred. Purely for the moment that things fall apart, that they are ready for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the best crews are people that have no... They do not communicate on the deck. They do not need to say, belay. It just happens. And they're always confident that they're capable of that. And it's not in their... It's not because they can't say that they're going to be able to do it next time. They're just going to do it as good as they can.
What is belay?
And
now, I do understand what you're saying because... Now, in my very first couple years working, there was that sense. It was a sense of shared mission.
Mm-hmm.
But then
in the software industry,
we got acquired by larger companies, and all of a sudden, there's a bigger system.
You became a human.
Become part of a cog.
You become
a human resource.
Yes.
You became resources for somebody else to use. Yeah.
That's what happens when admirals come in. Well, it's true.
That makes sense. That makes
it's
sense.
It's true. I mean, and I don't mean to be, you know, overly zealous. I just said I have actually seen this.
Right? Overly zealous.
In action. I've seen people working
that
here.
That makes real much sense.
This article what we just read rings very true to what I've always believed, that a good captain with a respected crew, with a crew that understands the intentions,
can do things that no other group can do.
Why did Jesus have 12 close disciples? Well, there's many different theories. Now, one of it is that he was establishing a new Israel, so he had to pick 12 to represent the 12 tribes of Israel, which makes theological sense. But at the same time, from sociological research, 12 is about the upper limit.
Where of trust.
Yeah. Beyond 12, you have to have policies and regulations.
Well, what Ray is saying is utopia.
We can dabble our side.
And utopia can exist on a fishing vessel. It can exist on a small company. Because I have seen it in small companies. Mm-hmm. And you said it exists in small groups. It's not just the fishing vessel. But
small groups that have a common mission.
What may have even existed, maybe, in the United States at its inception, I don't know. But reading history, I kind of don't think so. But every once in a while, we see a glimpse of utopia. Now, here we are trying to poke holes in and saying, no, that can't happen. We can't have utopia. Yes, every once in a while we do get a glimpse of utopia.
Mm-hmm. But then,
as humans,
but then we try to organize it.
We want to preserve
we
it.
Try to
sometimes
we
that happens.
Try,
it seems to be inevitable. It doesn't have to be, but it seems to be.
We
but
want to preserve it. We want to find a way to replicate it.
Yeah, we try to coordinate and replicate. The admiral comes in and says, okay, here is what you're going to do. We've seen utopia.
Yeah.
Here's what utopia looks like.
Someone writes a book, and then another organization takes it as best practices.
Yep.
Oh, utopia!
That's the point that I mean. You take that, say it was a storm, or it was a certain crossing that had to be made, and they came through, everybody worked diligently, the faith of each other was perfect, and the cargo was met. Now have the captain write the exact instances that he related to make that happen down, and everybody will try to follow that, but guess what? That crossing is never going to happen again.
It's not about that.
It will never happen again.
You say, okay, this person fulfilled this role, and this person was in this role, and this person was in this role, so now we are going to recreate it, and we are going to assign the roles.
Yeah, but guess what? You're
going to
have thought the next day. You know, you'll have something. And yeah. So, like, the situation is
the personalities
can
be different, and things evolve, and they're supposed to. You're supposed to create your own utopia rather than legislating utopia.
Yeah, you can't have a mandate. There will never be a mandate.
Coordinate utopia.
The utopia ownership
that makes sense.
Is not a product of the organization.
Comes in and
it's a product of the individual choices. The individual choices individually chose to abide by these five principles, and that created utopia. It wasn't the organization.
It's not these principles.
It's about learning to trust on one another.
Yes, I like that. You know, at work, there's CNAs that work trusting that the other CNA is doing exactly what they're supposed to, and then there's other CNAs that work on the opposite thing, that say, no, you're not doing what you're supposed to
do, and you've got to do this, and I think maybe you're not going to do this, and you've got to...
Well, you know what, Sally's, we were having such a grand time at one point.
Yes.
We
you had Utopia.
A lot. We had Utopia.
And, then
and we really thought we should go around Alaska and show everybody else how to, and the Admiral's like, urge! But it wouldn't have really worked to go anywhere else and try to show them because there's different personalities. We had a group that was working. Yeah. We had six people that were working very sweetly together, and we produced a lot of energy. But you can't go and put that onto another person.
So, Ray, you can kind of have a utopia on a vessel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you have the utopia on two different vessels?
Yep.
Are they the same?
Oh.
Yeah.
Not in the slightest manner at all.
That's why you can't go around and preach your utopia, because it's not...
You can have a lot
because
of...
Because utopia does not... Is not... Utopia isn't a standard. Utopia isn't something to be organized and recreated.
It is the efficiency of the faith of the people in the group that are working together with each other that makes that situation what it is.
And a group certainly can have a leader or some leaders who may have some final say in things. But the leader does not believe himself to be more important. That is the key there. That's what Jesus demonstrated, is he never claimed to be more valuable or important than any of the disciples.
People.
He was a teacher, and people looked up to him. It was not an imposed authority. It was an earned authority.
Right. The crew may actually take care of that person more. There may be more of a, you know, this person needs to have a better cabin, or this person has obtained a right from us to be in that position because of his ability to lead those people faithfully with them.
It's because the crew has determined that they need it, they deserve it, that they should. The crew has determined that that person should have it, rather than it is mandated that that person shall have it.
That's right.
One time I did something for services. I was so close to actually literally losing it. But I designed these 16 by 24 styrofoam cabins to go out, and they're very economical. You can build them anywhere. And a crew of about four people could build one in a day, and it was a neat idea. So I dreamed up this whole thing that on the back of the Wrangell Rangers District parking lot, we would take volunteers from the employee group. There's 34 people that work in the district. And we would build this cabin in one day in the parking lot. I had done that in the field, and everybody just has a blast. We did it in the parking lot, and it was, it was horrible. Everybody did. One-upmanship, everybody wanted to be boss, nobody would listen to nobody. The pandemonium that went on when you have too many people doing the same job, by the end of that day, I was totally...
Oh, my goodness.
You would have had total...
It backfired.
Yeah, I just totally... But you take
you
the same...
You had experienced utopia.
In the field.
Uh-huh.
And that's fun. Everybody, there was no...
Uh-huh.
It was just great. Did that in the parking lot where other people were watching...
My. Huh.
Everybody remembers that day.
I certainly appreciate reading this that way because that's kind of what I get out of it.
Babylon, so therefore, is about imposed authority. And it works. It works. Imposed authority does work. With enough power, it works.
Well, you had a navy with oarsmen, and those oarsmen didn't have a great life, but man, the country survived.
Now, with enough power, we can impose enough fear, and fear causes motivation, and eventually things work. Maybe not as efficiently as, or maybe very efficiently.
For a while.
But...
Until somebody more clever and more powerful
The warning of Revelation is to not fall to the temptation of succumbing to utilizing imposed authority in order to further the work of God.
Well, I guess that may be a classic case, because I'm not bragging, but when I worked in the field with the crew to build that cabin, it was a team effort, and everybody respected each other's skills. When I was in town, I should have implemented authority, because I had the authority to do that. But I tried to use that same technique in town with a at-large group, and it didn't work. And so in town, authority would have worked, but we didn't have it, and it was chaos.
That's your double-edged sword, though, because look at the story of Bly. See, he got on a boat where his authority was... Bly was so good. He was so good that he couldn't let anybody else be as good as he was. So the crew was never good enough. So those people on that crew despised him because he was too good. He was so good that he made everybody else completely inferior on that boat. And believe it or not, when they shoved him off on that little tiny boat to get there, literally he was the reason why the rest of the people on that boat lived, because he was that good. He got that boat where it needed to go. But nobody respected him for it in the end, because his imposed authority was so great. But the other aspect of that is if you look at what happened to the people that left that and took the boat, their inability to work together collectively was also their demise too, because that was a horrific story from the beginning. If you read all three of the stories of that situation, there was nothing good that came out of any of it because of the inability of all those people to work together. And that's the...
Did they all die?
No. Bly went on to live and have an astonishing career, and the people that ended up at Pitcairn, they eventually ended up dying horribly, miserable.
Pitcairn Island. Right.
And the people that finally made it out in the end found faith, but it was way too late. They had already destroyed themselves utterly. But that's a really great way to look at it too, because you think of it as like people all working together, and there's somebody that's good at something and people follow them. But there's also the somebody that's really good at something and knows it and can let people follow them. And that's a big thing that we have to all work at ourselves sometimes, is because that man was literally a nautical genius, like beyond his years, and could have made naval and maritime business beyond what it was at his time, but because of his arrogance and not being able to work with anybody, there was a great intelligence lost at that time.
Cook was an excellent mariner. He was good.
Yeah.
And everybody loved him. His protege was Vancouver, who was very good, but he wasn't that good as a leader, and so he kind of failed, which is sad because he did great things, but he wasn't the leader that Cook was.
Business and sociological studies have shown that a team that works well can accomplish a whole lot more than a collection of great individuals who don't work well together.
In the early 60s, the government did a lot of tests with young people in different camps. And my dad has a book, they studied a lot, and they tried to use different motivations with the different camps, and one of them was to compete, and they had some deaths, and they had to stop the study.
With? Who do you work with?
The government was doing that.
I know, but he worked with...
Well, the Job Corps, he was reading those books because they were trying to explain to the Job Corps leaders what does and doesn't work for motivation.
So were they using Job Corps people to try this?
No. The study happened.
Oh, good. Job
Corps. You know, that red camp and the... You know, it's just like Boy Scouts, and they just had camps out there. They competed, and they got wicked.
So
mankind will turn itself and start killing itself real quickly if you let them.
It's about priorities. It's relationships over rules and regulations. Rules and regulations have value, but not when they store.
When they become the goal.
When they supersede relationships.
Right.
That was what I always. I've never been a very good. I was never a leader per se. I'm in most situations totally, but I have seen those situations where it was not about like the monetary gain. It wasn't about being the best crew. It was just that people were just like they were happy to be there. They were proud to be doing what they were doing, whether it was just loading the bait jars. That person was excited to do that. And that's where it worked the most. I'd never seen it work where the motivation of the crew was the monetary compensation at the end of the day. I'd never seen it where it was the admiration of the captain that those people felt that got them where they needed to go. It was always just that everybody was content with
their
place.
You can get work done that way, but you can't experience utopia.
You can't, there's no fluid and solid motion that's working together. It's always just
absolutely efficient. Everybody knows what they need to do and enjoys doing it. And,
Right, because there would always be a
and
time.
And well organized if there isn't an official organization.
Yeah, the church is not about efficiency or productivity or
and
maximizing
it
profits.
It becomes about those things.
When it becomes about those things, what you end up with is abuse.
Mm-hmm. People become resources. People become resources.
And they get tired.
Wow.
They get tired of those jobs too, and they get to
God has infinite time. The church has infinite time. Our individual lives may not have infinite time, but the church does.
Western thought, European thought. You know, time is valuable. Indian thought, who cares? And what you're kind of saying is, you know, we think that our structure is important. Time is important.
It's, you know, the church is not about maximizing efficiency or productivity. It's about maximizing relationships.
Oh, siesta in Mexico. That's just anti-cultural.
Efficiency or what?
Efficiency, productivity, profits, whatever you want
to
call it.
Taking a nap in the afternoon is wicked.
Yeah. If God wanted the most efficient organization, He wouldn't have done what He did with Jesus.
What was the money for you used?
Profit.
Productivity.
Profit.
I put zeros that I could use.
That too.
Infinite time.
It's not because those things are bad. It's because those things don't work. And that's what we don't understand. It doesn't work. It does work. I mean, look at Henry Ford. Did he have growth, efficiency, productivity, profit? Absolutely. Was he happy? He was not a happy camper.
Hershey tried to do that, though.
But maybe Henry Ford did experience utopia for a time.
Maybe in his young life.
Yeah, maybe he discovered. Maybe he discovered good things and experienced utopia.
Do you know where he was the happiest man?
Organize and reproduce it. Where?
He was the happiest man. He built Greenwich Village. And in the back, he reproduced a old-time red schoolhouse. And the employees would send their kids to that school. And it was a classic old little schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. And Henry Ford would sit in the back row during school day and observe. That's when he was
cool.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe one of the problems we as Christians today have with like apocalyptic writings is that the end is so near, and so we have to be more productive about getting the, that message out.
We've got to organize it.
Let, you know, the end is near.
Quick, clear hat, let your hurry.
And I think as what we're seeing in Revelation is this is the end is near is
relative.
Yeah, it's fluid.
Well, you know, Jesus said, see the harvest as the people were coming out from Samaria. The harvest is ready. But he wasn't in a hurry. His whole time on earth was very fluid. Very, he was working with these 12 people and they didn't even get it. But you know what, if that was his mission, to let them know exactly certain things, he could have pressed it that way. You know, he could have been militant. Mm-hmm. He could have been, you know, he could have turned Jerusalem upside down.
He kind of did.
In a way, but he still left it intact.
Technique was different, but he did.
Well, last night when we evacuated all the residents, we did in some ways experience something of a utopian, yeah, the camaraderie. We're having an unplanned party here. But if we were to say, every other week we are going to do this and it's going to be organized right and it's going to be organized well, with the residents be cheerful and
yeah, on the fifth time they'd be like, why are we doing this again?
I can
the residents didn't complain. They didn't grumble very much. Most of the residents were cheerful and content with the situation most of the time. It worked really well. But if we decided to organize it and reproduce it and
there was a promoting effect that had happened.
Well, certainly.
There's the sudden.
A lot of them are the best, man.
There's the sudden imposition of chaos, and people do what needs to be done in a chaotic situation.
Everybody felt like they were worth something.
Yes, right.
They were needed. Doing it all the time is the biggest difficulty there is. Mm-hmm. Making yourself and your actions daily count like they do during a stressful situation is sometimes difficult. Because the mundane activities will always make you feel like, I don't have enough time for this, or this is ridiculous, or why are we doing this?
And that is the exact atmosphere that developed out of World War II in England and the United States. Everybody was able to grasp onto their vision, and it was the focus of the countries was something that's usually not. Well, obviously, it didn't happen in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.